Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Achtung, Achtung. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland. And we're using German today for a very, very good reason, aren't we, James?
Yes, we are. We've got a German guest. You know, and I think a criticism that can be laid at our door is that we're possibly a teeny bit Brit-centric. I think it's a good thing.
Steady on, old chap.
But I think it's a very, very, very good thing to get the view of the other side of the hill, particularly from a number of German historians and academics who are doing really incredible work in furthering our understanding of the Weltkrieg. And today we have Jens Wehner, who is the curator of the Bundeswehr Military History Museum in Dresden, which I visited in the past, and it is a really, really fantastically good museum. It's got this brilliant approach. It's a wonderful building, and inside it's all kind of really clean, and it's one of those museums where you've got space to breathe. You know, you're not bombarded with lots of screens and press this and get a smiley face and, you know, press this and get someone's audio on something. It's almost artifacts of history as art in a way, and it's much more profound. And just before we came on, we were talking about one particular exhibit, which is an exploding hand grenade.
Yes, you sent me a photograph of that, and it's incredibly striking because it does look it's like an abstract, like an impressionist picture of a thing.
Yes.
Although obviously what it is an impression of a momentary concrete reality, which is a grenade exploding and firing red hot metal everywhere. I mean, it's incredibly striking as an image.
It absolutely is. And what's incredible about it is you just look at just how many bits of very, very jagged red hot metal that represents. Yeah. And as Jens was just pointing out a minute ago, weren't you, Jens? Mm-hmm. That's not even all of it.
Yeah, actually, it's an artillery shell, 8.8 centimeter from Czech Republic. And the most splinters in a grenade are very small. You can't see them with your eyes. And so we are not able to exhibit them. But they are most deadly because they are very fast and they hurt the body very bad.
Yes, and quite often, you know, there are occasions where someone would be found and they said, you know, I found Peter sort of lying by a hedge and his body seemed completely unmarked. And that's because he's got an absolute minute splinter that's just pierced his part or the back of his neck or head or something. Yeah. It could be anything, and that's what's done for him. But it's a very, very powerful image, and you've also got a whole series of suspended bombs kind of falling from strings as well, which I remember. And I think you were responsible for that. So thank you for your work on that.
Yeah, I mean, I was one of the curators of the permanent exhibition of the museum. And we have a second way, or let's say a two-way approach in this exhibition. One is the classical chronological part, where also the grenade can be found, you mentioned earlier. And on the other side, we have a cultural topical approach, like military and technology, protection and destruction, military and fashion, military and music, military and language. And so this is a two-way approach in our museum.
So essentially how the military reflects society sociologically, how it's placed and its action and effect on other parts of society and culture.
Yeah, we see military and all the stuff that belongs to military, technology, uniforms, orders, behavior, as a part of human culture, in a sense.
Well, I've got to say, I've always been a little bit obsessed about how different uniforms were in the Second World War. So, a British uniform at the start of the war, it's very pragmatic. It's just functional. There's no amazing design to it.
Cheap.
It's very cheap. Yeah.
Excuse me.
and to a certain extent, exactly the same with the Americans. The Americans is reflective of the fact that this is a rapidly growing civilian army. The main jacket that your infantryman would have been wearing at the start of the war is based on a pre-war civilian wind cheater. And yet the Germans, of course, it's certainly in the Blitzkrieg years, it's jack boots, it's very well tailored, and it reflects a different, totally different society, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you can't explain the uniforms, I would say, without the symbolism. I am not an expert on uniforms. We have a researcher, an academic for this in our museum. But when it comes to uniforms, you have to keep in mind there is a really important symbolism behind this. And let me explain that in one example. We remember the SS mostly with the black uniforms, yeah? But during the war, most soldiers of the SS, officers and so on, wanted to have a field gray uniform like the Wehrmacht, because the soldier had a higher status than the SS man in the black uniform. Yeah, so this means, so that's the reason why if you look at, let's say, SS troops that did some murder in the Holocaust, they mostly have field gray uniforms. Yeah? They wanted to have it, and even the Gestapo guys wanted to have a field gray uniforms, because for them it was much cooler, to say it in a modern way. Yeah.
Well, because field gray, the army is more prestigious than a political...
Yeah.
Gosh, how interesting.
From the World War One and the society before World War One, the Kaiserreich, as we say in Germany, and there the soldier had a high status, and of course this was true also for the National Socialism.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Well, that
heavens,
really
I did not know that. I'd have thought, my immediate assumption would be that would be the other way round, given the prevalence of National Socialism at the time. Gosh, how interesting. Now, Jens, can I? We often ask our guests this question when we have guests on, just to sort of to get to know them. How did you end up specializing in this? How did you end up interested in this? How did you end up being interested in the Second World War? Because in the UK, when I was a boy in the 70s and the 80s, it was a massive part of British culture. A celebration of the Second World War and of British victory and all that sort of thing. So how do you come to it as a German? How have you ended up doing this job?
I'm only able to guess. I would say I'm grown up in Eastern Germany. And their military, and especially the East German Army. My father was an officer in the East German Army, and I had a lot of propaganda about the Red Army and how brave they fought in World War II and how good they were and so on, and how they liberated Europe. And so I was generally interested in military history, also other ages of war. And when I was, let's say, around 10, my father decided to write an academic thesis about the Soviet remembrance literature, meaning officers of the Red Army that were published in German. They were translated from the Russian books to the German books, to German language. But then he canceled this project and chose another one that was not so much political and propagandistic and so on. And so he dissolved his books into my room because we had not much space. And so I read, let's say, 80 memoirs of Russian officers and soldiers from World War II, mostly. Yeah, I mean, fighter airplane pilots, which is also what I'm doing a little bit now about my PhD thesis, but also Shukov and Konev and all the guys. Of course, this is the propaganda literature. Those are the censored books. When I was 11, suddenly everything I read was not true because the wall came down. And now we had the Western view of World War II. Yeah. And so the Soviet fighter pilots, for example, they were no brave professional heroes. They were just cannon fodder for the German aces like Erich Hartmann and so on. And this brought me into some questions. How is this possible? How is it possible that two sides have a very different story of World War II and what happened? Yeah. I mean, you have to keep in mind this was 1990, when most archives, especially in Russia, were still closed. I mean, it's even today not that simple to get in an archive, I think, in Russia. But many things were not known, whether to the East, neither to the West, Western guys, Western historians. So I think those are some inputs from my personal story.
Goodness me.
Yeah.
God, I mean, you couldn't get a further, a more different approach to the subject than the one of Alan Mine. And I think, you know, frankly, yours is a much better way of getting into it than watching war movies and reading comic books. But well, there's an argument for it anyway.
Well, that immediately raises so many questions, Jens. I mean, because after all, there you are. With this East German, that you have an East German perspective, I think is a thing that maybe people in the UK don't consider when they think of how Germany dealt with the war after the war. Mm. I think our experience and our focus has been on how people in the West would cope with it. And after all, that you would then have to go through this sort of cognitive shift from the Soviet Union and the Red Army were excellent and heroic to then the Western version of it as well, where actually they were terrible and they're incompetent. Has that led you to reappraise that reappraisal, though? Do you now think that the Red Army don't fit the second stereotype as well as the first one that you grew up on?
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. So, I mean, the socialist system we had in the GDR and the Soviet Union was, of course, authoritarian, very propagandistic, so a very straight way to tell the people the so-called truth. Yeah. So, I mean, the Western research and is, of course, in a more liberated society, in a more, of course, it's a democratic system. So I think they never were this straight and this stereotype as we learned it in the GDR. But it had, at least, and maybe it has today, some weaknesses, I would say. Let's say it this way, yeah.
Yeah, well, because a lot of it, because, I mean, one of the emphases that has existed in British and American historiography about Germany's performance in the war is how the Germans are better at everything. They have better equipment. Their army fights better tactically. You know, they're better motivated and all this sort of thing. And part of the problem, and that's a product of the Cold War as well, because after all, there was this business of having to get West Germany on side and to be nice to it and to overlook some of the things that happened in the Second World War to make an ally of Western Germany.
But it's also, and because people in West Germany and during the Cold War are the only people who've actually fought the Red Army.
Yes, well, that's all part of it. But that too has led to a problem of, well, you end up not being able to explain some of what happened. If the Germans are so brilliant, this, that, and the other, well, what? How come? You know, as one of our contributors put it very bluntly, how come they lost? So if the Red Army are so terrible, how come they won? You have to then do that as well. Don't
exactly. Yeah, that's one question. Of course, you have the explanations like, oh, they had the higher numbers, which is, of course, true, yeah, and which is, of course, a fact that is not really strong in a Soviet propaganda literature, yeah? So you see how propaganda works, yeah? Of course, if you read especially memoirs or books with more novel style or so, you see also that the Soviets always do like they were outnumbered, yeah? Of course, this is a fact, yeah. But of course, you have some objective explanations, but that's not all. Of course, it has also something to do with quality in some way, quality of operational warfare, quality of technology, quality of armament, quality of decisions also. Yeah,
And quality of morale as well.
Quality of morale, very important, of course.
Here we are talking about the East, because we don't talk about the Eastern Front enough. And I think If there's one battle for people first acquainting themselves with the Eastern Front that sort of encapsulates it, and we talk about this very often about decisive battles in the Second World War and moments where the German regime surely should have looked and thought, hang on a minute, we've lost. And I think Stalingrad is the battle that probably is the headline battle of the Eastern Front for people from the West, certainly. Even though they don't know about Bagratin, they don't know about... They don't Case really Blue know what happened whatever. At Kursk.
Yes, what's happening happening at Sebastopol, do they? I mean,
And so on. But Stalingrad is a good battle to sort of get to grips with the problems the Germans are having and the successes that the Soviets are capable of, isn't it?
Yeah, I think Stalingrad is more problematic because it's known for a very well reason, and this is, again, propaganda, because... I was astonished when I curated the exhibition how much media coverage was about the battle, even before the first German troops entered the city. I had an internship, a student, and I gave him the order, let's say it like this, to research German newspapers from this time about the word Stalingrad. When is it mentioned? And he discovered that it was mentioned 1 month before in three German newspapers. We choose three, one regional from Dresden, where our museum is located. It was the Völkische Beobachter, so the central national socialist newspaper. Yeah, and a third one, I think from Western Germany, I can't remember the name. And it was really astonishing how much media coverage was there from German perspective. And so I looked on the Allied side and I nearly found that, let's not say the same, but similar aspects. Yeah. So the Soviet media coverage about this battle was quite huge. And of course, the media coverage, I would say, in the US and also in Great Britain or the UK was also quite huge. And the second reason is this battle was very long, so over months. Yeah. So if you say they entered... The first reports were 1 month before they entered the city. This is, let's say, in August 1942, and the battle ended in February. So this is really a long time to have media coverage about one battle. Let's say Kursk. If you choose the German definition of Zitadelle, it's only 1 or 2 weeks. So to give some implications why we know this battle so well, it's not the only reason, of course. Of course, it was also an important battle, maybe not the decisive one or the turning point or whatever you want to call it. You can discuss these topics or these facts, but of course, the media coverage was very high.
Huh. And do you think, I mean, the whole point of Case Blue was to get into the Crimea, get down to Baku and get to the oil fields, and they get sort of sidetracked by Stalingrad. Stalingrad is not the main aim of the summer offensive of 1942.
Absolutely,
the
right.
main aim is to get oil. You know, this much needed resource of which the Germans are so short. You know, their only oil supply comes from Romania.
Yeah.
So to get to the oil fields is you know, that's El Dorado. It's the Holy Grail, isn't it? That's what they're trying to do. I mean, you can argue about what they would have actually done if they'd ever got to the oil fields without the Soviets kind of burning them first anyway, because they didn't really have the means of transporting it. But that's another matter. But they get siphoned off to Stalingrad. It's never the main point of Case Blue. Do you think, how much is it just because it's called Stalingrad?
Not very much, to be honest.
Not at all.
A little bit, maybe a little bit, because this is media coverage, and the media is, of course, very interested in constructing such duels, Hitler, Stalin, Stalingrad, whatever. But if you look at the original Case Blue, Fall Blau, as we say in German, you see they only wanted to, to destroy the city, yeah, but not to conquer it. They planned to destroy the city, and as you said, I would totally agree, it was about the oil fields, about the oil wells of Baku and the Caucasus. And during the battle, they had a wrong estimation of Soviet forces. They thought the Red Army was much more weaker than anticipated. And so they decided to conquer the city and at the same time to conquer the Caucasus. And this was, I would say, in the, let's say from our perspective today, a failure, a fail.
But you would call that mission creep in modern parlance, wouldn't you? You would say that that is, you know, your main aim is this, and they're veering off from their main aim. Suddenly, mid-operation, they're changing their plan.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, they changed it only a little bit. They changed it from reach the city and destroy the city first and then go into the Caucasus to conquer the city at the same time we go into the Caucasus. So they split the forces. So, I mean, this is a modification, and I wouldn't say it was the complete reason for the fail of Case Blue. Of course, this was the Soviet resistance in any way, no matter if it was in the Caucasus or in Stalingrad. But of course, it made it, as you say, mission creep also, something like this.
But one of the great strengths of the German and before them the Prussian forces in going all the way back to the 18th century is this idea of the Schwerpunkt, this kind of concentration of force in a kind of sort of rapid movement. Mm-hmm. Bam, you go straight in. By splitting your forces, you know, you'd have thought by the summer of 1942 the German High Command would have worked out that the Soviet Union is a very different place to the Low Countries and to France, just in terms of scale. I mean, it's huge. So what on earth are they thinking, suddenly splitting their forces? You know, if their main goal is to go and get the oil fields of the Caucasus, what are they doing having this kind of quite major diversion towards Stalingrad?
Yeah, but I think, I'm not an expert on the thinking of the German High Command of this time, but those things I have read in documents and books and so on is that they were really quite desperate at this time already. Yeah, so, and what's interesting, I would say, is they changed their expectations about the war itself, I would say monthly. Let's say in 1 month, yeah. They said, I am thinking we will win this war in some weeks. And in, on the other next month, they say this will be a long war, 30 years or so. We will fight this year war because the enemy is very hot and so on. So they had not really a good estimation of the situation. You could say they have a bad situational awareness. Where are we? How strong are we? How strong is our enemy? And so on. So the estimation is not right. And mostly it's an underestimation of the enemy. Yeah, this is something which led to the whole case Barbarossa, the whole campaign in the Soviet Union, an underestimation of the enemy.
Which actually, when you think about it, is something that the Germans are guilty of throughout the war. I mean, you know, I hate to bring it back to Britain, but I mean, they underestimate Britain in 1940.
Yeah,
you know, they're constantly underestimating even the USA and certainly the Soviet Union. I mean, you know, the thinking in the spring of 1941 is, well, we've just conquered France and we've, you know, run amok over half of Europe. Soviet Union, I mean, how hard can it be? Failing to appreciate the fact that the sheer scale of the Soviet Union is one of the huge obstacles that they've got to overcome.
I think the underestimation comes from two parts. One is the racism of the National Socialist leadership, of course. So they were not thinking really that the Russians were able to produce so much tanks, so much modern tanks, so much modern airplanes and so on. This is one thing. And the other thing, they didn't recognize how much the Soviet Union changed in the 20s and 30s. This is also something that happened a little bit to the Western allies, I would say. They also had not so much high hope on the Soviet resistance, especially in 1941, but also in 42 or so. The pictures they had in mind were this is an agriculture country, as we know from the empire, from the Russian Empire. And of course, under the rulership of Stalin, which was a very brutal rulership, of course, with lots of murders and so on, millions of victims, was also an industrialization. So many factories were built. And they didn't recognize this correctly, I would say.
That's very interesting. That's a thought I've never actually considered. Mm-hmm. That one of the reasons why the Western allies are so panicked about what's going on in the Soviet Union is because they also, like the Germans, have underestimated the strength of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've just never thought of
it. I think Richard Overy is noting this out several times, that the Western allies in 1941, in June 1941, when the campaign was started by the Germans, they had not high hopes on the Soviet Union. And even up to the Battle of Stalingrad, let's say end of 42 or so, it was not a very high appreciation of the Soviet resistance capabilities.
But that's a product, isn't it, of no one really knowing whether the Soviets are ever telling the truth, isn't it? Partly from the interwar years, that there's been so much. First of all, Bolshevism is regarded as an aberration, as dangerous, as chaotic, rather than a thing that might be able to organize an industrial revolution, which is what happens in those 20 years, as you're saying.
Mm-hmm. And also, if you want any proof of that, you've only got to look at Finland, haven't you?
Well, yes, yeah. But it's not just that, isn't it? It's that you know, the people who have been to the Soviet Union from the British press tend to be people who want to see the bright side, want to see the good stuff in the Soviet Union, fellow travelers. And so there's not been a serious assessment in British opinion, certainly in British opinion, of what the Soviets are capable of at all, for in the same way that there hasn't been in Germany either. I mean, but after all, fashionable British society and British politics doesn't like Bolshevism at all, doesn't like the Soviet Union at all, and is scared of it rather than assessing it, taking it seriously, which is why, after all, you have people in British society prepared to give the Nazis a pass until very late in the day. That's right, isn't it, James?
Yeah, absolutely, because their cousins have all been murdered by the communists in 1917 and 18.
Yeah, and so on, yeah. We have to take a short break here, fascinating as it is. Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. We're talking to Jens Wehner about Stalingrad. When the Germans commit themselves to the battle in Stalingrad, is there ever a time during that battle where there's a feeling that they've bitten off more than they can chew, that this is going to go horribly wrong? At what point do they realise that this battle isn't playing out the way they expected? Though, of course, as you've pointed out, Jens, they've changed their minds about what they're trying to achieve. So how it can achieve what they set out to do is quite difficult to quantify because they don't know what they're trying to achieve. They've changed their minds. When do they realise it's going wrong?
I'm not sure, but I would say when the encirclement took place.
Yeah, well, it's fairly obvious then, yeah. Isn't it?
and even then, I would say they had not a really good appreciation of the situation at all. Yeah, and so I would say it's very, very late when they come to a realistic picture of the situation.
I mean, that's amazing. And do you think, Jens, that one of the reasons they can't get out of Stalingrad and can't just sort of pull back is because in the news they have made such a fuss of it, and so therefore to retreat is too big a humiliation. You know, you've started, you've made this big fuss about Stalingrad, it's in the papers, everyone's, you know, it's on Die Wochenschau, etc., etc. Are you then kind of, to use a phrase, kind of hoist by your own petard, you know, in so much that you've so publicly committed, it's too humiliating to back out? I mean, obviously, you know, the whole Hitlerian view of generalship is to never surrender, never give an inch. But somehow it's more so at Stalingrad. Do you agree with that, or is that off the mark?
I would approve it, but I would say it's not the whole picture of the story. It's one important part. But I would say they also had, even before the encirclement, quite heavy problems with their logistics. I wrote an article about this, which is also available in English, by the way. and the point is, when they moved into Stalingrad in September of 42, they fought a battle up to mid of November 42, so let's say 2 months, where street battles in Stalingrad. And during this time, the logistics were very bad. They had really problems to supply the troops in Stalingrad and of the whole 6th Army already. So the rations, the food of the soldiers, had to be cut by half several days before the encirclement took place already. So the German soldiers already had not enough food to eat already before the encirclement took place. And they, of course, they had also a lot of other logistical problems, especially in fuel, tank ammunition, and so on. So, and this is also a reason why it was not so easy to retreat from Stalingrad or to say, oh, we should retreat or we should stop or whatever. Yeah.
But how has that come about? I mean, how has that not been anticipated? Why did the Germans not predict that in this vast expanse of the Soviet Union, they're going to have supply issues, you know, where the railway lines have to be changed because they're a different gauge, where they haven't got enough fuel? I mean, is it because, yes, but that was the whole point of Case Blue. We said we were going to have the oil, so we didn't need to worry about it now because in a couple of months we'll have it. I mean, is that the reason? I mean, because it doesn't seem to me that you need to be a rocket scientist to realise that any operations in the Soviet Union are going to be very challenging in terms of logistics.
Because they think all the time the Russians are quite desperate too, even more than they are for themselves. Because the defensive action of the Russians in Stalingrad, which is only about 10% of the city near the river Volga, of course, it looks desperate even today. Yeah, if you see how the Soviets throw their divisions into it, and they were and they had very high losses. I think the 13th Guard Division is the most famous example. Yeah, which was, I think, there are stories they were destructed within one day. So a whole division was in a meat grinder and was destructed in one day. And of course, this looks desperate, but. And maybe it was for the Russians to hold the last part of Stalingrad, the 10%. It's only about the industrial quarter of Stalingrad. So 90% of the city are in German hands. So, of course, you can't get the impression. And the Germans had not really a good picture of the whole strength of the Soviet Union. Yeah, about, let's say, the troops that were concentrated to do the encirclement operations, they didn't notice it, or very late, only several days before. There were the first messages about this from the German intelligence, as far as I remember, at least. And of course, the Soviets had still a very strong concentration of troops around Moscow, and maybe even stronger than around Stalingrad. So maybe you can say it's not even the main front for the Red Army at this time. And I think most German officers didn't notice that fact, and so they thought the Soviet Union was at the point of a defeat, next to the point of a defeat, but this was completely wrong. And there it is, the underestimation. Yeah, and of course it had something to do at one point of very good Soviet camouflage. Yeah, of very good top secrecy in Soviet. General staff and so on, to hide the troops, to play down the troops and so on.
So the German assessment either goes from we're going to it's a house of cards, it'll collapse any second, we're going to kick the door in and the Soviets will collapse. It fluctuates from that to they're fighting much harder than we thought, this war's going to go on forever.
Yeah, and the funny thing is this happened 41 already too.
Yeah, yes, because it does definitely happens in 41, doesn't it? Is that they get off to a good start and then think, hang on a minute, this is taking a lot longer than we thought it would. And it flip-flops, doesn't it?
It flip-flops, and of course they have also huge military successes on an operational level, also in 42. And you see also the Soviets are at some points very desperate. Take, for instance, Stalin's famous order, Ni Shaku Nazad, no step back, where he ordered in summer 42 not to retreat, and those who retreat have to be shot by NKVD also. So the rates of shootings of own soldiers in the Red Army are rising, not that high as it is mostly said, but they were rising, of course. So you see, even the Soviets have, of course, their desperate times, and of course the Germans noticed that. And so This makes it, I think, a little bit quite harder for the Germans to estimate the situation correctly, especially when they have, let's say, something like no strategic intelligence. So they have not a real impression of the whole strength of the Red Army and the Soviet Union.
I mean, strategic intelligence is really, really interesting, isn't it? Because, again, to go back to 1940, they have a complete misappreciation of the strength of the RAF. British Isles, the British Armed Services, the Armed Forces, how it works. They have no concept there's an air defence plan around Britain. It just isn't there. And again, it just isn't there in 1941, and it isn't in 1942 either. And it's incredible, really, that in a way the German Armed Forces get as far as they do when their strategic intelligence is so woeful. I mean, it is really bad, and it's incredible how good Nazi Germany is at intelligence on itself. Goering famously has his own intelligence service, which is entirely his. It's private, it's separate from the state. And the main reason for that is not to keep tabs on the Soviet Union or on Britain or the United States. It's to keep tabs on other Nazis, so that he can always be kind of one up. I mean, it's incredible. And yet the strategic intelligence is really poor. And boy, does that get them in hot water. But I wonder how much of that is how much of the misappreciation is also tied into this figure of the Führer at the top, and that what he says goes, and he has to be right about absolutely everything, and he's surrounded by sycophants, and what he decides is the law, and no one's going to disagree with Hitler. So, I wonder how much his own misappreciation comes into it.
Yeah, good question. Next question. can't really say how much Hitler. Of course, Hitler is responsible for the military disasters of the Wehrmacht at this time. Yeah, so 42 Stalingrad is also on his list of failures. But how much he really? I would say most German generals hadn't the will to give resistance to Hitler in a military way, because they had the same appreciations, the same guessings, the same pictures in their mind about the Soviet Union. And as I said, even the Western allies had some impressions that were similar about the weakness of the Soviet Union. And so, I don't know, I think this is Hitler is for sure a very radical and a racist guy. And so, of course, he has a deterministic underestimation of the Russians because of his racism. But in some ways, it also fits in the general approach to the Soviet Union of the German general staff and so on.
Yeah, well, the German general staff know there's been a purge of the officer class in the Soviet Union as well, don't they? So they're looking at it like that too, aren't they? That this army isn't professional. How could it be? And that they're factoring that in as much as anything else. And I'm sure that the first few weeks of Barbarossa, that people still keep thinking, well, we can do that again, because the victories in the first few weeks of 1941, of the campaign in 1941, are spectacular. So they must be thinking, we just need to get into our groove and do that again, and the Soviets will tumble. I mean, this is also a thing that the British, right from the start of the war, think at some point that Germany will fall in on itself, and all it takes is an event to make that happen, to make it, they certainly think that before May 1940, the British and the French think, well, it's only, all we've got to do is blockade Germany, and Germany will fall in itself. And everyone's misappraising everyone else throughout the war, actually. Because after all, I mean, you look at the defeat of Germany at Stalingrad, although, as you're saying, it's more to it than meets the eye. You might expect, for instance, the generals to turn to Hitler and say, right, we've really lost badly here, it's time for you to go. But they don't do that. Where does the locus for the blame of the defeat in Stalingrad then move to after the end of the battle? Does von Paulus take all the blame, or does it move... Where does it move in the German high command? Who ends up taking the rap?
Yeah, it depends from the time we were talking about. Of course, in the Third Reich itself, there was no blame because the Germans always do everything right because they are the superior race, so they can't be a fault like this, let's say it so. But after the war, I would say it's mostly Göring because of the air bridge, airlift bridge, yeah, that was not sufficient. It was also, it's often Paulus because he is the head of the Sixth Army, of course. It's of course Hitler because he lost the war and he is responsible and he's deaf, so he can't defend himself. Same for Göring. Paulus was a little bit odd, at least in the Western views, because he changed sides and lived in Eastern Germany after the war here in Dresden. And so he was seen as a Soviet puppet, which is in some ways maybe true, in some ways not. And so you see, those were the guilties of the Battle of Stalingrad,
right.
In some ways.
So at the time, is it sort of treated, because if the Third Reich can't admit that it ever got anything wrong and made a mistake, how do you then present to the public? Because you talked about the media before, right at the start of this, you said, well, you know, look at the media. This battle's going to become a headline battle because it's being written about even before it's happened. How do the media then serve up the defeat at Stalingrad to the German public?
Actually, maybe this is the greatest success of Goebbels, of the German Minister of Propaganda, because he made a propaganda that is later called Kraft durch Furcht, means power by, what's the English word for this? So the people live in angst, yeah, for the Soviet Bolsheviks, yeah. So, and he, in German, there is this famous organization, Kraft durch Freude, means power through happiness. And this is changed into Kraft durch Furcht, means, the Bolsheviks are coming and they will devastate our territory if they come into Germany. And so we have to defend, and Stalingrad is a fanal, a sign to resist against the Bolsheviks. And there is a famous speech in the Sportpalast in Berlin, yeah, called Wollt ihr den totalen Krieg? Do you want the total war? And all the people are crying, yelling, yeah, we want to. It's Wochenschau, I think. It should be quite famous. And yes. And this is quite a propaganda success for Goebbels. So that's the way they sold it to the people. And of course, there was a speech of Göring at the end of the Battle of Stalingrad at 30th January 43. And they told the people a line, every German soldier that fought in Stalingrad is dead because he fought to the end. Until he was killed by the Red Army. And of course, this was not true because roughly 100,000 were marching into Soviet captivity.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. I mean, it is very interesting that because we've talked about the Sportpalast speech. It keeps coming up.
Well, it's such a marker, isn't it? Because you can argue that militarily, Germany had already shot its bolt much, much earlier than February 1943. Mm-hmm. But psychologically, in terms of this, there is this terrible realization in society in Germany that, oh my God, you know, we are up the proverbial creek without a paddle, and you know, you reap what you sow, and everyone knows the essence of what has gone on.
I mean, we don't have good documents like polls or so about the German public opinion at this times, but the scientific research, the academic research tells us that picture of Hitler was already declining since the end of the Battle of Moscow in 41, yeah, because this was also quite a disaster of the Germans in the winter of 41-42. Of course, Stalingrad was another defeat, but I wouldn't say it was, at least for the Germans, that psychological turning point. One reason I told already was the Goebbels propaganda. The other reasons was that it was quite... simplistic argumentation to say, oh, of course the Russians are fighting good in winter, but we the Germans are well in summer. And so you can really observe, I would make that point strong, that the morale in Germany was more rapidly declining after the lost Battle of Kursk in summer 43. Because this was a summer battle and the Germans lost it too. At least this is something some academic researchers are saying, and I would support this thesis.
That's fascinating. So of course the Russians are good at fighting during the winter. They know the winter, they live with it. We're on a path to the ultimate victory. There are going to be setbacks. And come the summer, that's what we're good at. And so Kursk then represents the pricking that myth. And you've Hamburg that summer as well. So
yeah, you have Hamburg, you have Kursk, you have Sicily, you have some air battles like Ploiești or so. So this summer is really disastrous for the German.
U-boats defeated in May.
Yeah, of course. Africa is lost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, this is just fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really is. Thank you. So Jens, I know you're still finishing off your PhD about the Luftwaffe, but, you know, once that's completed, it would be fantastic to get you back on to talk about the Luftwaffe, mm-hmm. about which I think it's fair to say I'm reasonably obsessed.
Yeah.
And talk some more.
Yeah, of course, we should do. I know your books. I know a lot of British books about the Battle of Britain. Very interesting.
Well, I'm looking forward to that then.
I would also urge after the, when is it, 16th of May or whenever it is, we're allowed to go abroad again. I would urge, well, whenever we can go abroad or whenever anyone's in anywhere near Dresden, I would fully recommend visiting your museum, which is mm-hmm. really, really fantastic. Really is a wonderful
museum. We have also a showcase about the Battle of Britain, of course. Yeah, I mean, every nation has its battles. Yeah. That's what it likes. When I started the PhD, I made a research in the British National Library about the topic Battle of Britain. It was very interesting how much books there was. And for the Germans, for instance, it's really Stalingrad. A colleague of mine who is also an expert on the Battle of Stalingrad told me, and the Russians, because he speaks Russian fluently, I'm not so well there. He said Stalingrad is for the Germans like the Pavlovsche dog, you know, the Pavlov dog. I don't know how you call it in English.
Yeah.
So Pavlov's, they always react if they hear Stalingrad. It's one of the battles that fascinated Stalingrad. And you can see it because Stalingrad is still the most visited exhibition in our museum up to date. Yeah, we had a huge visitorship for Stalingrad. So this is, let's say, a very important battle for the German history, at least in the minds of the people.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, you know, and as you well know, the Battle of Britain is too. But equally, the Battle of Britain is probably one of the most mythologized episodes in British history as well. Even though there is so much, it's understandable that you might mythologize Alfred the Great or the Norman invasion of 1066 because it was a long time ago. But 1940 was a pinprick in time ago, and there's huge amounts of material on it and archival material on it, and yet it still persists with this narrative myth, which is just frankly nonsense, most of it. So it's interesting.
And a point about the Battle of Stalingrad is also it's some way a Europe battle, at least the Eastern Europe battle, yeah, with the Romanians and the Hungarians and the Italians. And I had really a hard try to find exhibits from those armies who fought at Stalingrad, yeah, because at least 10 years ago, it was not that well researched when it comes to the Romanians. And I would say also the Russian history about this is not very well. So the Russians are mostly concentrating, of course, on the Germans and the Wehrmacht and so on. But I mean, you had two Romanian armies that were nearly completely destructed during the battle. And they had a role, like the Italians or the Hungarians. Those were also very hard battles for those nations in their history, especially if you look at a country like Hungary, where this is a quite small country in comparison with Germany also.
Yeah.
And they had huge losses at this front, or the Romanians also. So this is also an aspect that is really, I don't know the today current status. Maybe I can imagine there is some more written yet than 10 years before when I did this exhibition. But I think there are still some questions about this, which are quite important.
And that must be, I mean, partly because in the Cold War, you know, you're not going to talk about that, are you? Because they're Warsaw Pact countries, you're probably best not discussing the time that the Red Army destroyed your army, are you? It's best leaving it alone. And you don't want to talk about that either.
Yeah.
I imagine that when you sided with the Nazis, you know.
And I think every society has a tendency not to talk about defeats.
Yeah.
I would say. Yeah. I think this is one of the most reasons. And from this point of view, Stalingrad is an exhibition, but this is an exception. But it has something to do with the whole defeat of the Germans in World War II and what World War II was for the Germans with the Holocaust and the terrible war crimes and so on. So this is a special situation for the Germans at this point.
Well, Jens, thanks so much for coming on to talk to us. I mean...
got lots to think about there, isn't
there? Oh, but there always is, Jim. There's just so much to think about.
Yeah, me too.
No, thank you so much. And as James says, certainly when I get the chance to leave this Plague Island, which we're trapped on, I will come to Dresden and visit the museum, because I'm very much look forward to being able to do that.
Just write me a message if you want.
Absolutely, no problem. And
Jens, please keep in touch, because
we do, of course. It's set.
And send us the link for the article you mentioned earlier on, because I'm sure our diehard listeners would love to read that about Stalingrad and the media.
Yeah, it's fantastic. On an academic platform, free to read, I think, in English.
Fabulous.
It was published in Russia, but in English.
Wow. Well, thanks for joining us anyway. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you again soon. Cheerio.
Bye.
Cheerio.